Okay, so remember the theme of the lectures is there are certain capacities which are very distinctive of us as human beings, which are not presupposed by language in the sense that we can easily envisage a relatively straightforward information exchanging language that can come on stream without people having to have had those capacities prior to coming on stream. And that language, or the advent of language, or speech, and that of course is understood to include sign language, gestural language, as well as the language we're familiar with or think of, that language, the onset of language, is going to bring on stream, or as I put, catalyze, or precipitate the appearance of these very distinctive capacities. In many cases, it seems pretty clear that language is necessary for those capacities, in particular the ones I've spoken of in the last couple of days, but I don't argue necessarily that it is essential for all the capacities I looked at. And we looked at judgment, reasoning, certain sort of perceptual consciousness, the capacity to commit, the capacity to perform as a person that we described the last day with a self. And today I'm going to look at the capacity to assume responsibility, to be held responsible, to hold another responsible, and each to assume responsibility, to assume that the ascription is appropriate in their own case. And remember, I've been working with this sort of genealogy picture. We're thinking about creatures who come to speak in this way without previously having had these capacities. And we're looking at how, in a sort of thought experiment, being able to speak would bring on stream these capacities. Okay, so to begin on the responsibility theme. When I hold you responsible, it seems to me, and this may be debated, I suppose, but it seems to me there are two things I assume about you. The first thing I think I assume is that we share certain value judgments, and it's in the name of those shared values that I hold you responsible. So I take it you have a capacity to make value judgments. And the first thing I'm going to have to argue, obviously, then, is that minds that speak, the sorts of protagonists in our genealogy, are going to be in a position to form value judgments. Up to now, the judgments, and I've talked of judgment a lot, that we've taken them to form could be purely descriptive or non-evaluative, as we put it. But the second capacity I presuppose in you is that not only can you form value judgments of the kind that we share, but that you also are able to control for whether or not you live up to those value judgments. This, in ordinary language, I guess, is to assume that you have a sort of free will, that it's up to you whether or not you conform to these value judgments you make. So the second thing I'm going to have to argue is that there is some sense in which we think that minds that speak would be able rightly to assume of one another that they have this capacity to control for acting on the value judgments that they share. And of course, if you yourself acquiesce, so to speak, in somebody else taking you to make value judgments or taking you to be in control of whether you act on those value judgments, if you yourself acquiesce in that, then of course you assume responsibility, as we put it. Okay, so to begin with, the capacity to make, maybe one comment. I can see that some people might well think, well, wait a moment, you don't normally get a discussion of the assumption that when I hold someone responsible, I assume there are shared value judgments. And couldn't I hold someone responsible for not living up to his or her value judgments, even judgments that I don't share? But it seems to me, in that case, we still share some higher order values, which is the value we're living up to, so to speak, the value judgments that you perhaps idiosyncratically endorse. So again, they're going to be shared value judgments. This at least seems to me to be a requirement of standing when you blame someone, that you assume a certain shared capacity for value judgment. That's why I put it in here. So, so first question then is, would minds that speak come to make value judgments? Is there any reason why speech would, so to speak, egg them into, catalyze this capacity to make value judgments? Well, let's think first of all about what it is to make a value judgment. And I'm going to assume that there are three things true of a value judgment. The first thing is that when you make a value judgment, like, and it may be in any form, like it would be right to X, it would be good to X, it would be attractive or appealing, or normatively, let's say, attractive or appealing to X, it could be any of these forms. The first is that when you make a judgment of value about Xing or an action like that, then the first thing you do is you're prescribing, presumably, at least pro tanto, you're prescribing that action for whoever is being addressed. Of course, it may be yourself or it may be another person. And you're not just prescribing it as an authority might give an order, you know, do that, so to speak, or else. No, you're prescribing it on a presumptively, in a presumptively grounded way. That is to say, there are, as you assume in making value judgments, there are considerations that support the prescription. So number one, you're prescribing in a presumptively grounded way that the agent addressed should perform X. The second thing true of a value judgment that's really important is that a value judgment may often come apart from the actual desire that the person addressed has. So suppose I'm saying to myself, I ought to X, or I believe it's desirable or valuable or good or right to X. Of course, I'm going to recognize, I won't understand what a value judgment is unless I recognize, that it's quite possible to believe that Xing is valuable, to judge that Xing is valuable, and yet to find you're drawn in your desire not to X to do something quite different. So there's always a possibility of a clash between a value judgment and a desire. And the third feature of value judgment is that as we think of them, and I think now I'm explicating a shared notion of making a value judgment here, and then we're going to ask whether the minds that speak would make judgments fitting these conditions. The third thing, of course, is that we think of value judgments as judgments such that when they do clash with desire, when an agent's value judgment clashes with his or her desires, then it's a sort of failure to go with the desire rather than going with the value judgment. You've got to give up on the desire and go with the value judgment if, as it were, you're not to count as failing in some intuitive sense. We'll come back to what that sense is and make a sense of the notion of a failure. But you wouldn't understand what the value judgment was unless you thought it was a prescription to act on presumptive grounds. It's likely to clash with the desires of the agent, and yet, given the agent shares that value, it would be a sort of failure on the part of the agent not to actually go with the judgment, to go rather with the desire. And so now the question is, would minds that speak in my little genealogy, would they be likely to form value judgments of that kind? And I say that they would. And in arguing that, I start from the possibility, which we've already discussed in the fourth lecture, of avowing not just beliefs, but desires. You remember when you avow a state in, by use of the word avowal, you're communicating it to somebody else, like your belief or a desire, but you're communicating it in an especially costly or expensive and therefore credible way, because in avowing it, you're manifestly putting aside or foreclosing, denying yourself, renouncing the possibility, if you fail to display that belief or that desire in action later, you're putting aside the possibility of saying, oh, I must have gotten myself wrong. You're putting aside the, what I call the misleading evidence or misleading mind in this case, excuse. So you're not, in reporting on anything, you can always give that excuse. I can get away with it, but you can offer it. In the case of an avowal, it's just not available. And that's manifestly the case. So that when you avow a belief or a desire, rather than just merely reporting it, as in, gee, I find I desire, I think I desire, I think I believe. When you avow it, like saying P rather than I believe the P, or like saying that'd be good, you know, rather than saying I think I desire that, then you deny yourself this excuse later, which means that other people, this being manifest, are aware that you're taking on the extra expense, so you speak with a certain weight that you otherwise wouldn't have had. And of course, you assume a certain authority to be able to speak for yourself in that way. Okay, now let's take it that these creatures will certainly avow various sorts of desires to one another, seeking to make it credible to the others that they have those desires. Maybe a desire for peace, maybe a desire, you know, not to squabble about such and such, maybe a desire to go their own way when it comes to matters of religious belief, whatever it might be. Let's suppose they avow a desire like that. Well, presumably, if I avow a desire, first of all, I'm going to now talk a little bit about avowing a desire and then argue, you know, that gets awfully close to making a judgment of desirability. So when they avow a desire, they presumably are going to be, they're going to want to be pretty sure that they actually will have that desire and be likely to live up to it, be capable, so to speak, of living up to it. And that means that they presumably will only avow desires such that they can see desiderata, properties, that weigh quite strongly with them in favor of acting as that desire would have them to act. So, you know, when I avow a desire, for example, for peace with my fellows in this community I'm living in, when I avow that sort of desire, presumably it weighs with me that, well, of course, if I have peaceful relations, I'll be able to trade with them, I'll be able to make friends with them, we'll be able to do things together. Those are powerful desiderata, which leave me in no doubt but that I will probably continue to desire peace, and so I can avow it with a certain degree of confidence. Okay, so it is always possible, however, as I see it, that even when I avow a desire for peace, you know, I later find, gee, I could, you know, if I just sort of allowed myself a chance to go in and equip some of these goods or whatever it might be there, I'm breaching the peace or pushing him aside and getting at something, it can be manifest to me that I get a great advantage. So I can now see, though I avow the desire for peace, that there will be, as it were, occasions when I'll, maybe an impulse, I get really annoyed with this guy, I really want to hit him, you know, I'm surging with anger. It's going to be clear to me, even as I avow the desire, that it's going to be possible, of course, that I'm going to be, as it were, put off my stroke, put off my stride, that I'm going to find at a later point that a desire, like an impulse, is overwhelming me. And this in the following sense, that not that I foresee that I might change my mind and think, oh, well, peace isn't all that hot after all, you know, because after all, you know, much better to have sort of peace most of the time, to grab an advantage like this for myself when I see one. It's what I foresee is not that that will happen. No, rather, I recognize that I'm subject to sort of impulses, you know, obsessions, whatever it might be, habit, you know, opportunism, such that even though I give in to that impulse and I don't live up the desire that I avow, I won't be able to say of myself, change my mind about peace. You know, it won't be that a new desideratum has come on stream that I acknowledge as a ground for, as it were, disavowing the desire that I previously avowed. Now, what I foresee is that I continue to avow this, the desiderata are still there that support it, and damn it, I go with the desire, you know, the experienced desire, in this case the impulse, rather than the avowed desire. And what I can also foresee in the notion of I, one of these protagonists, in the notion of avowing a desire, that if I do give in that way to the desire, it's going to come across to me, I'm going to rate it as a sort of failure. Because after all, it'll be a failure as a presumptively, purportedly, commissive agent. After all, and that goes back to the theme the last day, talking about what it is to be a person, is to be someone who personates, who holds out a persona, who invites others to rely on them, who says, this is me, this is who you can rely on. Now, as a commissive agent of that kind, which is tied up with just being a person, as I argued, as a commissive agent of that kind, I'm bound to foresee that, you know, if I do that, I will really, in my own eyes and by these criteria that I've sort of signed up to implicitly, I will have failed. It'll be a failure in those commissive terms, in terms of the practice of commitment that's so basic to the life of these creatures as I've described them in the genealogy. And of course, as I'm suggesting, by analogy, are actually true of us, even though they're existing in a counterfactual world. Okay, so now there's the thing about, we can imagine the creatures vowing desires on the basis of desiderata they're confident about. We can imagine them finding that on occasions the experienced desire clashes with the avowed desire. And we can imagine them giving in to the experienced desire, particularly if it's an impulse, an obsession, a bout of anger, whatever it might be. And we can see that they will regard giving in that way, not living up to the avowal, as a sort of failure. Okay, now at that point, what I want to say is that the avowal of a desire, understood in that way, has exactly the profile of a judgment of desirability. So if I have avowed a desire for peaceful relations with my neighbors, with those I live with, I really have done something that's tantamount by the account I gave at the beginning, the three-feature account I gave at the beginning of judgments of desirability. I will effectively have made a judgment of desirability, a judgment that peace with my neighbors is desirable. Why so? We'll go through the three characteristics. Well, first of all, he said the judgment of desirability is a prescription to act on presumptive grounds. Well, if I avow a desire is tantamount to a prescription to act, and it's on the basis of desiderata that give you confidence in having that desire, so it's very like a judgment of desirability, a recommendation on a presumptively grounded basis to do whatever it is you vow the desire for. Secondly, I said the judgment of desirability may clash with what you actually desire, and of course that's true too. The desire you avow may clash indeed with the desire you experience. And the third one I said is that it's going to count as a sort of failure, otherwise you would not understand what the judgment of desirability was. It's going to count as a sort of failure if you go with the desire rather than with the judgment of desirability. Now, an avowal of a desire of the kind I described is playing exactly that sort of role. Now, not an awful lot's going to depend on this in what follows, but I'm going to assume in what follows that we can think of these creatures, in virtue of these considerations, as making judgments of desirability. Now, of course, there are different words involved in making a judgment of desirability, for example, and different concepts involved in making a judgment of desirability. And what I would say in response, of course, to that is that, yes, but they're in a position where, you know, they can identify actions that have the feature of their having avowed them on pretty stable grounds, and also other actions which have the feature of having desiderata in support of them, such that did they think about it, they would avow a desire for the relevant action. And in that case, they're in the precinct, so to speak, of having a concept of desirability. It wouldn't be, imagine they use a word for those actions that answer to their avowed desires in this sense. Well, the word they'd use is a word we would naturally translate into English as desirable or valuable or whatever. And so they're going to be in a position, so I'm going to suggest to you in the genealogy, in this story I'm telling, to be able to access the concept of desirability and to be able to make judgments of desirability, which will play exactly the role of avowals of desire as I've just described it. one thing to add is that, and I talked about this now a lot in some earlier lectures, is that of course many of the desires they will avow not explicitly, but as I put it, virtually. Because there'll be many situations, and imagine just any sort of social life, in which it's manifest to each of us that each of us clearly, as we say, or manifestly, is going to want certain sorts of behavior, certain sorts of actions, and it's manifest to each that others expect them to want those, to desire those. And it's manifest to each that, of course, they could say, don't hold me to that, you know, I don't think I've made up my mind in favor of that, of avowing that. And that all being manifest, if they say nothing, you know, in that context, they're likely to be taken, and they know they're likely to be taken, to have effectively avowed that desire. They're manifestly expected, and they are manifestly able to say, don't hold me to that, and they don't say, don't hold me to that. They don't say yay to the avowal of the desire, but they don't say nay when they could have done. And so I'm going to take it that there'll be many desires in the community which people will take one another to avow, even when those of us say nothing, and many desires that each will recognize that they are taken to have avowed by their very silence, as it were. One final remark before leaving this argument that minds that speak would have the capacity to make value judgments, because that was the first part, remember, of holding someone responsible. And it's this, of course, when you avow belief, as in making a judgment, you can ordinarily expect that other people will come to agree with you on the judgments that you avow, because when you avow them, presumably you've got data there, otherwise you wouldn't be so sure about believing them. But the data for you are going to be data for those other people, putting some qualifications aside. And so you can expect, so to speak, that the beliefs will avow, there's an expectance of convergence there. Now, there can't be that same expectation with the avowals of desire, because, of course, the things I desire, I may desire from quite different perspectives that actually can clash. So I may, from the point of view of someone interested in his or her own life as it evolves, have a certain desire, let's say, to get a certain career, to achieve something or whatever. That's not a desire I could expect anybody else to have for me, short of my parents maybe or something like that, a very close relatives. Equally, I can have a desire as a member of a particular group, or a particular gender, or an ethnicity, or a community, or a subgroup, or a culture. I can have desires, so to speak, in that identity. And these desires may all clash with one another. Equally, I can have desires that, so to speak, I have as a human being who wants to, you'll all hear the Scanlon sort of overtones or undertones, a human being who wants to be able to justify himself or herself to others, as to what they do and desire. I mean, that's an identity you assume. If Tim Scanlon is to be believed, it's the identity of someone who thinks in this moral way, that I think as someone who wishes that the actions he or she should take are going to be defensible, justifiable to others. There are going to be actions such that no other can have a reasonable complaint against your doing them, and so on. That's going to be an identity too. There's also going to be an identity, I suppose, if you think it's distinct from that, which I actually think it probably is, the identity of thinking from a universal point of view. Think of Sidgwick when he talks about, the point of view of the universe. You might have desires, about how future generations will go, about climate change and so on, which are very different. The perspective is very different from that of the prudential standpoint, or indeed the group standpoint, or whatever. So there are going to be many, many sorts of desires that can be avowed, and correspondingly, there are going to be many sorts of judgments of desirability. There'll be judgments of prudence, for example, of what is desirable from a prudent point of view. There'll be judgments, I suppose, of patriotism, I suppose you might call it, what's desirable from the point of view of your country, your patria. There are going to be judgments of universal benevolence or whatever. That's just a note I want to, I'm not going to talk much about that later, but without putting in a place, it might seem that this is all gobbledygook. Okay, so judgments of desirability come in many different forms. All I've wanted to try to persuade you is that these creatures, in virtue of speaking, are going to, and speaking in purely descriptive terms initially, but are going to be led to certain sorts of speech act, avowals, in particular avowals of desire, that are going to take them into, so to speak, the country of making judgments of desirability. Okay, so that's the first half of the two theses that I want to defend, the easier one, unfortunately. The second one is that if I hold you responsible, I said I not only take it, we've got shared values, so I take you've got a capacity for value judgment, but secondly, I take it that you must be in control in some sense of whether you conform to those value judgments or not. if it were, so to speak, anyone's guess, if it were up to the heavens or the stars or fate or the neurons, you know, whether or not you conformed, then I couldn't hold you responsible for living up to those values. Okay, so in this case, in this second part of the lecture, the argument is going to come in three sections, which I have, I've put down three premises and a conclusion at the beginning of section two on page one. And the way the argument goes, just to rehearse it initially, is these creatures, in these protagonists in my imagined story, they're inevitably going to be, first of all, they're going to form certain shared and routine norms, subscribe to certain shared and routine norms with certain other groups. Now, maybe their society as a whole, maybe not likely though, it's more likely to be at least with a certain subgroup of, as we say, equals of those, so to speak, in their more immediate coterie. So they're going to, that's the first claim, that there are going to be shared routine norms to which they will all tend to conform, and they're going to judge conformity by anyone to those norms desirable. That's the first claim. The second claim is that with norms of that kind, they're also going to pledge to conform to those norms and therefore to act on the judgment of desirability, that conformity is desirable. And the third one is that, the third premise, that is to say, is that if any of them makes a pledge, they thereby, so to speak, they must be able to control for fulfilling that pledge. And so if they have all pledged to conform to norms, which by the first premise means act on their judgments of desirability about conforming to the norms, then in virtue of the fact that every pledge makes sense only in someone assumed to have the capacity to control for keeping the pledge, it's going to follow that they're going to treat one another, and I'm going to say rightly, as having this capacity to control for conforming to certain shared value judgments. Okay, so that's a bit of a mouthful. Let me go through each of those premises in turn, and I think it'll become clearer. So I take it that in any, now I'm going to talk about a community or a group or a society, but you know, one problem with thinking in the broad about a society is that we know historically that most societies are hierarchical and structured with norms of whereby some are enabled to dominate others and so on, and that warps the world, so to speak, in favor of some and against others. Now, I'm going to assume, though, that even in a society like that, suppose we think of the members being the alphas, the betas, and the gammas, even in a society like that, even the gammas are going to have some sub, you know, groups, subcultures, sub-communities with other gammas within which they are not dominated and within which they, I'm going to say, are likely to conform to certain norms in dealing with one another and indeed to judge their conformity to those norms as desirable. Okay, so though I'm going to use the word community or group or society, so remember it may often be quite a sub-society like of the gammas within the Alpha Beta Gamma society. Okay, so one reason why certain norms are going to almost certainly emerge in a society like that is that otherwise it's just going to be civil war. So for example, norms of non-violence, norms of telling the truth to one another, norms of, if they make pledges to one another, keeping those pledges, if there are property conventions, norms of, you know, respecting those conventions of property. In the sort of group I'm imagining, it's going to be a condition for the survival of the group, really, that they have norms like that. But let me do it slightly more analytically. Think from the point of view of each one of these creatures. They have to rely on one another. And that was part of our original assumption about their nature way back. They have to be able to rely on one another to survive, basically. So it's going to be important from the point of view of each that, hey, I can rely on others to treat me well, like to treat me without violence, to treat me without deception, without coercion, to keep their promises when they make them to me, not to steal my property and so on. That's going to be really important for each one of us. But now, of course, for each one of us, we can't really expect to be able to rely on others if they have found they can't rely on us, right? If we've let them down time and again, at least they're going to not have a motive for relying on us, for proving reliable to us if we rely on them, given we haven't proved reliable to them, tit for tat, as we all know. But it may even be the case that, you know, they're going to have a motive to punish someone who doesn't prove reliable, having given information it's deceptive, having made a promise, they break it. It's going to be in their interest to sort of teach the other, as we say. And there's a lot of psychological literature that suggests that is very basic in our DNA, as a matter of fact. So I'm going to assume that in order to be able to rely on others, we've got to prove reliable ourselves. And of course, equally, it's going to be really important for us to be able to get others to rely on us in certain cases. You know, if we want to, we can go and hang and hunt that stag, you know, the Russo example. Well, we've got to get others, you know, to be able to rely on us when we say there's a stag there and I'll stick with you. But in order to do that, we've got to have proved ourselves reliable. This is true from the point of view of each one of us. So each one of us must have proved reliably non-violent, proved reliably truthful, proved reliably faithful, proved reliably respectful of property under the existing conventions, and so on. So that's why I think that for any human beings, there'll be some groups such that within those groups, there are norms that get established in their dealings with one another, and they each are going to reliably conform more or less to those norms. I'm also now going to add something else, though. We assume, and I could have done it with just the avowal of desire language, but let's assume, to make it easy, as I said I would do, that they got the language of judging desirable. Now, for the moment, just stick with the avowing desire. They may each avow a desire to conform to these rules and other to one another. But even if they don't go through explicit avowal, they're each going to take it that others not only conform to these norms, but desire that everybody should conform to the norms, because the benefit to each is manifest of they're all conforming to those norms. Now, if it's the case that they each desire manifestly to conform to the norms, this means that others are going to recognize with any individual that that individual desires conformity to these norms. That individual, of course, it being manifest, is aware that others expect that of them. And so if they remain silent, they don't say, I'm not sure about this norm of sincerity and stuff. I think it's, you know, if they don't do that, if they don't disavow the norm, they'll be taken, so to speak, by default to have avowed it. Again, the silence will speak almost as eloquently, so to speak, as actual speech would do. So that in this community, I'm imagining it, they will each conform to these norms fairly reliably, and they'll each be taken and acquiesce in being taken to avow the desirability of these norms, to avow a desire for these norms. Now go into the language of desirability. That being the case, by the argument of the first section, if you'll allow me that, and allow it in here as shorthand, I ask you, they're each going to both reliably conform to the norms and judge that conformity to the norms is reliable. So what we have now is, we've explained why they should have judgments of desirability, that's section one, and now what we're seeing is that for almost every individual in the story I'm telling, there are going to be certain patterns of behavior corresponding to these norms of the community or sub-community. There are going to be certain patterns of behavior such that they're going to share judgments of desirability. It's going to be manifest to each of them within that community or sub-community that everyone thinks is desirable, right? Valuable, to actually conform to these norms. So not only do they have a capacity in common to make judgments of value or desirability, they actually are making common judgments of desirability about conformity to these norms. Those are shared norms, and they're, in general, I call them here routine norms, meaning that no one thinks it's very hard to tell the truth or to avoid coercion or to avoid being unfaithful, unreliable. Everyone's pretty well expected to conform for that reason, but equally expected to judge it to be desirable to conform. Okay, that's the first piece. Now, what I'm going to add in the second piece of the argument is that not only are they going to have shared judgments of desirability about these norms, the norms in question, they're actually going to effectively pledge to conform to, and in pledging to conform to them, they're going to pledge to live up to the judgments of desirability we've just said that they will endorse in respect of conformity of the norms. So they're going to make a pledge, as it were, to conform and to live up to these judgments of desirability. Now, why might this be so? Well, for reliance reasons, for reasons of reputation, they're each obviously going to expect others to conform to the norms within the community or subcommunity, and each is going to recognize, it's going to be manifest, that others are going to expect them to conform. That means that if they say nothing, they may be taken to be certainly going to conform. I mean, they could say, look, don't take me, I'm sorry, I realize you're all taking me to be someone who lives up to these norms, endorses them. Actually, I think it's a load of bilge and don't expect anything. They could say that, but they don't say that. They could say nay to the expectation that they live up to the norms, but they don't say nay when they could. And that's tantamount to saying, yay, okay, you can expect me to conform to these norms, which is basically, in effect, to pledge to conform to the norms. Okay, one problem, though. You might say, well, wait a moment. That's going to be so, and this is true, only if they're not saying nay, only if they're, call it, acquiescing in the expectation that they will conform, is a voluntary acquiescence. Now, that requires me to say something about what voluntariness is, and here's roughly how I understand what it is to do something voluntarily, like acquiescing in the expectation on your part that I will conform to certain norms. I say it's going to be voluntary, provided that there are alternatives that were more or less acceptable to me. So I chose this above those alternatives. The alternatives weren't so awful, that intuitively we say, well, I had no choice but to do this, you know, because the alternatives were so bad, the options were so bad. They gave me no choice. I just had to do this, say acquiesce. Now, you might think that, well, wait a moment, these people, maybe they don't say nay, because saying, look, don't expect me, would be pretty awful. Others would say, what sort of guy are you? You know, they would sort of really think very, very badly of the person, punish the person in a way, ostracize them. And maybe they don't say nay just for fear of the alternative. Maybe, therefore, their acquiescing in the expectation is not really a voluntary acquiescence in that sense. It's forced upon them by how bad the alternative would be. Now, this takes me back. There are a couple of things to say, but I'm only going to say one, and only one is on the handout. It takes me back to the assumption that we're talking about at least a subcommunity where relations are pretty equal. So it's not the case that for fear of being hit over the head by the big guy, you know, I don't say nay. I'm not in that sort of fear. I'm living more or less amongst equals. Maybe I've sought them out, you know, as in the gammas, seeking out one another, establishing subcommunities or whatever. And in that situation, presumably there's always a possibility someone can just exit that group, you know, go to another group. So that there is an alternative to not saying nay. They realize if you stick with this group, you more or less have to go along with this expectation that you'll conform. So in that sense, you've got to virtually pledge to conform. And I think that plausibly, when those sorts of circumstances obtain, you can say that they voluntarily, albeit virtually, pledge to conform to these norms. Now, if you give me this, where have we got to? Okay, so we've got to argue that there are going to be some instances for every one of them, more or less, where they make shared judgments of value or desirability with others, and in particular, judgments of desirability about certain norms, conforming to certain norms. But further, we've seen that with the norms in question, they actually pledge effectively, if virtually, only virtually, to conform to those norms, which is to say they pledge to live up to the judgments of desirability that they attach to those norms. Okay, so they're really holding out now a pretty heavy package on this story within the community, which is that, yeah, we all judge these, conform to these norms, desirable, and you can take me to be pledged to conform to those norms. That's where we've got to. Now, the third stage in the argument on this section of the paper is going to be that if you look at what happens when these people make a pledge to one another, you'll see that they assume in one another a control over whether or not to keep that pledge. Okay, so we're stepping aside from the main argument to just think about any old pledge, so to speak, within a group of people related in the way of our sub-community. Okay, so suppose in this sub-community, someone pledges to do something, I've called it X here, and of course it's worth remembering, if they pledge to do something like Xing, whatever that might be, they pledge to go on the hunt tomorrow, they pledge to join you in the fishing expedition, they pledge to not trample on the bit of land that you've been trying to raise some animals on or whatever. When they make a pledge like that, they do so presumably because doing that has certain attractions for them, maybe the attraction that you're going to treat them in the same way in response, but equally making that sort of pledge is going to be attractive for them, because if I make a pledge of that kind to you, then by living up to that pledge, I prove myself the sort of guy you can rely on, right? So it's got a lot of reasons in that sense why people in this community would want to make pledges to one another of one or another kind. But now, okay, so you've made a pledge on these sorts of grounds, it's attractive to you in various ways. Now, the rest of us recognize that you made the pledge, and the rest of us recognize that, of course, there are things that make both the action in question attractive to you, and, of course, in particular, the pledging and the keeping of the pledge attractive to you, that you prove yourself a man or a woman of their word, so to speak. Okay, but now notice that, and here, by the way, I'm going to be drawing on joint work with Tori McGeer, joint and published work with Tori McGeer, and somewhat on a book I published earlier this year, no, late last year, called The Birth of Ethics. So once it's recognized on all sides that if someone has made a pledge, they've done so on the basis of the attractions of the action or the attractions of the pledging, and that in particular, if they don't keep the pledging, they're going to get a name for unreliability. After all, they've pledged, they've let us down. Once that's true, then of course each of us is empowered in relation to that agent, right? Here's the agent, Chris, although he's moved out of position, right? And he's made this pledge to us. And here we are, we think, that's a good thing. You know, Chris has pledged to stay in the chair position in the department, the faculty, for another 5 years, let's say, okay? And we're really, we're thrilled about this and so on. But by making the pledge, he has actually empowered the rest of us in relation to him. Why so? Well, recognizing the features that might have made it attractive to him, Suppose now that Chris is showing signs of maybe pulling out of the job, resigning, whatever, and we're going to be able to say things to him like, come on, think about how it appealed to you, you know, all that power, you like power, right? And the fact that you brought order to the faculty, you know, that stuff like that. I mean, it's much improved, let's suppose. I'm not making judgment here. It's much improved. And, you know, we'll all slip back if you retire now. Come on, we say, Chris. You know, you really ought to stay in the job. We say, and you can. Come on, just think about those, you know. And then we say, and look, and you promised, for God's sake. Or, you know, that might have been implicit, you know. So what are the rest of us going to think of you, you know, if you let us down this way? Now, this is very interesting. What he's done is put power in our hands to exhort him, as we say, right? Because we exhort him when we say, you can do it, you should do it, and implicitly, you can do it, right? By drawing attention to the very factors that presumptively he was moved by in actually making the pledge, whether virtually or explicitly, in the first place. Now, what I want you to do is to think about the sort of can that I can use of Chris when we're in that position. I can say, you can do it. Or take maybe another example. Maybe it's Rafe. Where are you, Rafe? I've missed you. Yeah, there it is. Maybe it's Rafe. And Rafe has told me that he's going to tell the truth to his chair about some embarrassing episode, you know, whatever it might be. And that's great, and I commend him and so on. And he, as it were, promises me he'll tell the truth. But on the way in, he's obviously showing some signs of backsliding, you know? And I say to Rafe, come on, Rafe, you should tell him. Think about the reasons you thought, good reasons for, you know, for telling the truth to your chair about this embarrassing episode. And besides, I communicate with him, maybe explicitly, implicitly, that, you know, how do I want to think of you? What are the rest of us going to think of you who know you've made this promise? So we said, you can do it, right? You can do it. Now, think of, do you remember that children's story about, is it the chugging train or whatever, when the train, little train is saying, I think I can, I know I can, you know, going up the hill. I can. I can remember teaching my youngest child about going up a hill, you know, you can do it, you know. Now, that sort of can is a very interesting can. It's not the can of, it's possible that you do it. It's not a purely modal can. It's not even a rich modal can of the kind. It's robustly possible that you do it, you know, and under most very, you will actually do it. No, it's an exhortatory or hortative can. It's a can, as Tori and I in that paper called it, it's a can that's evocative. You know, when I say, you can do it, Chris, I'm not merely describing something as in, oh, by the way, I noticed you've got the ability, or Rafe, you've got the ability to tell the truth. Chris, you've got the ability. I mean, that would be ridiculous, you know, I'm just making a modal description of a modal possibility. Of course, neither is it a performative, you know, by saying, you can, I don't suddenly, you know, like Superman, you know, injected with can stuff that would get him to do it or capable of doing it. But it's something in between. When I say you can, I presumably, by that very utterance, are seeking to, I'm doing something which in all likelihood may help to make it true that he actually can do it, right? I'm trying to evoke the action of which I'm saying that he can do it. That's a hortative can. And I think it's a really important aspect of actually human life in general, but now we're talking our genealogy. These creatures, mutually reliant creatures, using speech to relate to one another, making pledges to one another, and so on, they're going to empower one another to be mutually exhortative or exhortatory in regard to certain actions. And that means they're going to have a certain stance on one another. You know, I'm going to see Rafe if we're in the thing, or I'm going to see Chris, imagine we're in this community. I'm going to see them as, each of them can do what I'm saying they can do. That each of them is exhortable, you know. Each of them, I see them, so to speak, from within. You know, Dennett talks about the intentional stance. I first talk here about the hortative stance. I see them from within a hortative stance, you know, as people, well, what? I take them to, when I exhort either of them to act in this way, I presume that they have, I display, express a belief that they have a capacity to respond to the sort of considerations that I'm putting before them. And the considerations like, Chris, you know, the order, the very fortune, the prosperity of the department depends on you staying in place, or to Rafe, look, you're going to be so ashamed of yourself if you, you know, you're going to think of yourself as a coward and so on. All of these, I'm assuming that they are in control of what they do, at least in the sense of being responsive to the sorts of considerations that I am putting before them. So that's an important assumption about the control I'm sort of ascribing to them insofar as I see them as exhortable agents. Of course, other people I might not see as exhortable. You know, I say, Johnny has promised to do such and such. Well, we all know Johnny, you know. No point in saying to Johnny, you can do it, you know, because we know he won't, you know, that sort of image. But these people I think of as exhortable, and these people in this community are presumably going to see one another as exhortable in that space, see one another from within the hortative stance, not a detached stance, a sort of second personal type stance, to use Steve Darwell's sort of notion. Okay, now with that in place, imagine what happens if it turns out that Rafe comes out shamefacedly and he tells me, I couldn't do it, you know. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't tell that story. I told me yarn about blah, 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 you know. Now, what am I going to think about Rafe? Of course, I could give up on him, you know. I could describe, you know, that's Rafe once again. You've got to give up on him, you know. I just resign myself to his being, as it were, a pathological liar or whatever it might be. He's not at all like this, I assure you. I might do that, and in this community, people might do that to another, but you can see it'd be a very poor strategy, because after all, it may well be that this was just a one-off, you know, that the next time around, these people are going to be capable of being exhorted, mutual exhortation, that it was a sort of temporary slip, a glitch, so to speak, that caused them not to be here. And to give up on them completely and say, oh, well, he couldn't have told the truth. That's Rafe, you know. Or with Chris, he couldn't have stayed in the job, you know, regardless of his promises. You know, he just tires after, he gets tired after a year, bored or whatever, and he just can't help himself. I could do that, but it'd be very, very bad strategy if these people generally did it. Now, suppose with either of them, we can transfer it back to the genealogy story, suppose with either of them that I don't give up on them. I think that, you know, with Rafe, it was a failure, you know, but next time around he might be better, you know. And in any case, I don't want to distance myself in the way I would if I sort of thought the guy can't live up, tell the truth and live up to his promises. And so what do I say to him in the wake of a failure when he comes out shamefacedly and tells me? Well, I think what I say to him, if I want to keep him within the hortative stance, so to speak, I say to him, you could have told the truth. Now, that could is not a modal could either. It's not merely, there's a possibility, even a robust possibility, that you should have told the truth. No, it's maintaining the same disposition towards him, the same hortative stance that I took in exhorting him ex ante. So this, as it were, ex post, saying you could have done otherwise, is said in the same spirit. I'm ascribing to him now a capacity I'm ascribing to him then, when he went into the chair, a capacity to have told the truth, and presumably I'm assuming that capacity remains there. When I say, now come on, Rafe, you could have told the truth. Of course, in saying that, notice I'm implying you did break, you know, the norm. You did break your pledge, sorry, in this case. He pledged to tell the truth. You did break your pledge. And I'm saying, and you had it within you. You know, I see you as an exhortable creature. You could have not broken your pledge. And I'm communicating both that you did the wrong thing, that you did at least in failing the pledge, but also that you had a capacity to have done otherwise, you know, which is awfully close to saying, in a common sense of the term, that he had free will, you know, to have done otherwise. Notice that I may not have had a chance to speak to Rafe before he went into the chair, or speak to Chris before he thought about resigning. But I might still say to them ex post, you could have done otherwise. You could have held on to the job, Chris. You could have told the truth, Rafe. I could hold on to that, even though I could say that, even though I hadn't exhorted them beforehand, because I believed that they were exhortable at that point. And it's in virtue of being exhortable, that is to say, showing up in the way they show up within an alternative stance, that I say, even if I hadn't exhorted them ex ante, I could say ex post, you could have done otherwise, and you should have done otherwise, and by implication, you could have done otherwise. So what is this to say? I've been trying to elicit this notion that there's an ex ante sort of attitude we have to one another, which I'm calling, I can't think of anything better than a hortative, or hortatory if you like, exhortatory if you like, attitude towards one another. We see one another as being responsive to the value judgments we share with one another. And we get very impatient in thinking, we think of each, you can do it, we think, with each other that we face. That's an ex ante sort of proactive attitude towards others. But now, as you can see, I think it maps perfectly onto Strawson's reactive, ex post attitudes. So when Rafe doesn't tell the truth, or Chris resigns the position, in the Rafe case, I may be indignant with him, you know? But that emotion is like the hortative attitude held ex post. That's what I would suggest to you. I know there's a knockdown argument here, obviously, but I think that's a plausible reading. And similarly, suppose I'm in the faculty with Chris, I'm really disappointed. I say, Chris, you know, I can really feel resentment, you know, towards him for letting us down in that way. And that reactive response is sort of the counterpart of the ex ante attitude I might have had in saying, you can do it. Now, so what I wanted to say in this third premise was that among creatures who make pledges to one another, they empower one another to exhort one another. As a result of that power, they see one another from within an hortative stance, as I'm calling it. And that hortative stance leads them, it's a sort of second personal stance, but it leads them also in the event of failure, where they think the failure wasn't pathological, so to speak, or it wasn't the result that the person continues to be exhortable, to see one another as, you could have done otherwise, and to return to trying to hold the person to the standard, to the ideal. And I want to say, they're basically ascribing to one another a sort of transmodal or a non-modal can, and the can answers, it seems to me, intuitively to what most of us have in mind. We say people have got free will. What do we mean? Well, at least one of the things we mean, it seems to me, is that when they make judgments of desirability, they can be responsive to those judgments. They can be responsive to the considerations that the judgments master. That's what it is to free will, as from being a slave of desire, so to speak. Think Kant, if you like, on this. They're capable of, as it were, recruiting reasons and authorizing reasons and being letting them dictate what they do, rather than being the slave of their impulses or desires that get carried along. And so what I've taken myself to sort of suggest, at any rate, not properly argue, is that these creatures would see one another as possessed in that sense of a capacity to control for living up to their pledges. Now, putting these three bits together in this second section of the talk, I've said that these creatures are going to have shared judgments of desirability about conforming to certain norms. They're going to pledge to conform to those norms and to live up to those values. That's the second premise. And the third one is that, now adding in the third, that in virtue of pledging one another to do that, they are going to take one another to have this capacity you might describe as exhortability, to have a capacity to be responsive to those judgments of value, and in that sense to have something corresponding to free will. And that's really the upshot of this second part of the paper, but I just wind it off with a comment. Libertarians, and I don't mean the political libertarians, but libertarians about free will, believers that, you know, real, non-physical, non-natural, non-causal free will, they think that, look, the reason you can exhort someone is that they've got this non-natural capacity to act according to their now non-physical, non-causal, special sort of will. And so you can exhort them, you know, to get them to let the will move them in this direction or that direction. I think it's actually got that exactly the wrong way around. I think that we creatures, by nature, by culture, by virtue of being mutually reliant and being enmeshed in commitments to one another, in particular pledges to one another, that we naturally exhort one another. And it's, we don't sort of exhort one another because we think that we have free will. Rather, we think that we have free will, and in an appropriate debunked sense we have, because we see one another as exhortable. That seems to me really very close to, now there are many readings of Strawson, but very close to one reading of Strawson, you know, in which to see another person as having free will is to see them as a suitable object of resentment or whatever. And I'm saying, well, ex ante, it's to see them as a suitable object or target of exhortation. And what we see in people when we see them as exhortable, we only see from within that stance. And it's a really important feature that marks off some human beings from others. As Strawson says, some we regard as exempt from resentment or indignation. Similarly, I think we regard some as exempt from exhortation. But when we take someone to fall within the, as it were, the constituency of exhortation, of mutual exhortation, we take one another within that constituency to have this really very special very important capacity. Okay, so putting the two pieces together, I think that minds that speak are going to invariably be brought to make avowals of desire that are tantamount to making judgments of desirability. That was the first section. So they're going to have access to the notion of value and of what's valuable. But I think, and that's the second section, that insofar as they make shared judgments of desirability, pledge to live up to them, they're also going to take one another to be possessed of that special capacity we call free will, which is the capacity to be responsive to those judgments of value. Okay, thanks very much.